Welcome to Twisted Travel and True Crime. I love traveling, true crime, and podcasts and decided to combine all three. My family and I live on a boat for half the year and plan to move aboard longer term to travel more extensively. While traveling, I'll be looking for true crime stories from places I visit or that have a hint of travel in the story. We are currently doing boat projects, planning for homeschooling, and starting to pack and provision for our third year aboard. To escape the chaos here, I want to tell you about the chaos that was caused by a man named Israel Keyes. Israel Keyes is a traveler, a planner, and a unique killer who doesn't fit the typical profiles used for serial killers, at least not the ones who have been caught, and at least not up until the very end. He was very intelligent and usually a meticulous planner. However, he stepped out of his modus operandi for the last kill he made, the one he was caught for. I believe he was beginning to feel cocky and sure of himself, and the urge to kill was stronger than it had been in the past. He ended up breaking one of his own rules, which was don't kill near home. Keyes was born in Cove, Utah. He was the second son of 10 children. They lived with very unique beliefs. They didn't believe in modern medicine. They didn't believe in religion or governance. They didn't send their kids to public schools. The children didn't have normal socialization skills. In fact, they were raised with no electric, no normal heating, and basically lived pretty rough. At age 5, him and the family moved to Washington. He lived there until he went to the Army in 1998. They lived on a mountain in a home with a driveway that was inaccessible the majority of the year, so they basically lived in isolation. While there, they joined a church called the Ark. That church believed that any race other than white was inferior, and even among white people, those who didn't attend the church were also inferior. It is believed that this contributed to the way he felt about people and could hurt them the way he did, and also the fact that he believed he was better than anyone else out there. He said he would let his victims come to him. He'd often wait in parks or on remote trails, and his victims would cross his path. As a young boy, he would hunt a lot, but his hunting wasn't for gathering food. Instead, he liked to torture and kill animals. He once shot a deer, and instead of putting it out of its misery, as it hadn't died right away, he cleaned it alive. He also killed and tortured animals in front of his friends. He couldn't understand why his friends would get physically sick or have to leave as he hurt these animals. He would also stalk his neighbors and often stole guns to use for hunting and torturing animals. By the late 90s, they moved once again to Oregon. Around this same time, he drifted from the family. He also expressed interest in Satanism. Eventually, he joined the Army. He liked the idea of learning survival skills as if he didn't have enough already. While he was overseas, it is said he liked to harass sex workers, especially in Egypt. Finally, he moved to Nea Bay, Alaska, and met a woman who was indigenous to the area. He was discharged shortly after and moved into his pregnant girlfriend's home. He lived there for 6 years. It was during this time that he admits to killing for the first time. He says when he was young, he read the book Mindhunter, and that it may have contributed to the ideas that he had growing inside his head. The book made him realize that there are other people out there like him, serial killers. He finally decided to act on his idea of killing strangers. He ended up breaking up with his first girlfriend and moved with his daughter to Anchorage, Alaska, and into the home of a new girlfriend. It's here where he got caught, so I'm going to tell you about that right now. 18-year-old Samantha Koenig was working in a coffee booth in Alaska on February 12, 2012. She was a friendly, outgoing girl who lived with her dad and her boyfriend. She had made plans with her boyfriend to pick her up later that night when she got done with work. That was supposed to be just after 8 p.m. When he arrived, Samantha was not there. The coffee shop looked like it had been closed up, like it normally was. He returned to his home, and she was not there either. Samantha was a homebody, so this was out of her normal routine. Several hours later, they received a text message that said she was tired of things and was going to take a vacation. It didn't make sense to them. They were all happy, and she was happy. The way the message was written also seemed strange. It wasn't in her style of speech or text. They reported her missing that same night. The next day, police went to Common Grounds and asked if they had some surveillance. The footage shows that at 8 p.m., a person comes up to the window and asks for a coffee. As she is handing it over, the suspect holds a gun and orders her to shut the lights off. She puts her hands in the air and backs up. She shuts the lights off and the person jumps into the booth. He didn't take anything except for Samantha. Then he came back later that evening and took her wallet and her bank card. Investigations started with close family, but very quickly they were eliminated as suspects. Next, investigators went to nearby businesses looking for witnesses or more camera footage. Luckily, they hit pay dirt. They found footage of Samantha and a man walking away from the coffee booth and getting into a white pickup truck. They identified it as a white Chevy. There were so many hits on the vehicle database, it felt overwhelming, so they brought in the FBI. The community rallied as well as the police force. Flyers were put up all over town, and a vigil was planned to help raise awareness. Nothing seemed to happen for 3 weeks, but then Samantha, and I put quotations around my words, Samantha sent another text. It said, "Connor Park sign under pic of Albert. Ain't she purty?" The family rushed to the location and saw a sign for a missing dog named Albert. Under this sign was a plastic bag with some paper and pictures of Samantha. The picture looked blurry, and there was a newspaper dated 4 days earlier. Police showed it to her father, and he said, "Yes, it looks like her, but she has a braid in her hair, and she never wore her hair like that." There was also a ransom note asking for $30,000 to be deposited into her bank account. The police liked this, so they put money into her account. The real reason that they liked it was because the only way a person could access it was through an ATM, and all ATMs have cameras. The police would get immediate notifications if money was withdrawn. Several times, $500 was withdrawn, and the local police would rush to the ATMs, missing the suspect by minutes. This was the most that could be drawn at one time. The surveillance footage didn't help either, as the person covered their face with masks, glasses, and gloves. This happened several times in Alaska, and then it didn't anymore. Suddenly, on March 7th, money was being taken out in Arizona. Police were baffled. They reached out to many police stations in Arizona, asking for them to keep an eye out for abductions or anything that might help their case. They looked at the footage from the ATM, but once again, the man was completely covered. The abductor did make one mistake, however. In the background, they saw a white Ford Focus. They believed that this car was involved. Information was shared throughout Arizona, but nothing came of it. However, another ATM was hit in New Mexico, and then a couple times in Texas. They could see that this person was following a certain road, and to look out for a white Ford Focus. A state trooper did end up seeing a Ford Focus that looked similar to the one being searched for, so he decided to take a closer look, and he pulled the driver over. The car had been at a motel. When the driver came out, it was a white male, so the trooper had waited until he made a simple driving error and then pulled him over. The trooper approached and asked for ID. The ID was from Alaska and belonged to 34-year-old Israel Keys. In the car, he found Samantha Koenig's ID and her cell phone and a gun. They bring him to the jail and start to look into his background. They find nothing other than an old DUI. He had served in the military and was in good standing. He had a small local business and was well respected in his community. They decided to go to his house, and one of the first things they see beside the house itself is a little white tool shed on the property. They also see the white truck that was seen in the coffee shop cameras. He gave nothing to the police while he was in Texas, and about 2 weeks later was shipped back to Alaska. Once he was there, he began talking. He admitted to killing Samantha, but refused to give any details until some of his demands were met. And these demands included a Starbucks Americano, a Snickers, and a specific type of cigar. He then told the story very nonchalantly. He said he was at the coffee stand and decided he was going to take whoever was in it. He picked it because it was open and that he didn't care who was inside. He asked for the coffee, then pointed the gun at her. He told her that if she would listen, he would let her go. This made her very compliant. He took her back to his house and put her in the shed. His girlfriend and his 2-year-old daughter were at home at the time. They had been told previously that they were not to enter the shed, as it was his private area. He turned on loud music and proceeded to sexually assault her. Then he goes back to the coffee shop to gather her personal items. He convinces her to give him her banking personal identification number. He checks her bank account, strangles, and stabs her. And then he shoves her into a box. He then goes home and packs his bag for a cruise with his family that he had booked several weeks earlier. He enjoys cruising the Caribbean for 2 weeks. Literally, the day after killing a young innocent person, he leaves for a Caribbean cruise. And the way he talked so matter-of-factly about this killing, with no emotion, as if he didn't care at all about what he had done, led police to wonder if he had killed before. He told authorities that while he was gone, Samantha's body had frozen. He then thawed her out and took makeup. I'm assuming it belonged to his girlfriend, which is really gross to think about, especially if he put it back afterwards. He then made her face up and braided her hair. He sewed her eyes open with fishing line so she looked more alive. He then took the newspaper from that day and placed it so that it was legible. He proceeded to Photoshop the photo so that Samantha was a little bit blurry and to help hide the fact that she was dead, but to leave the newspaper clear. He then dismembered her and took her body to a very deep lake nearby. He made 3 trips with her to the lake, which was busy with ice fishing people. In between ice fishing, he would slip her body parts into the lake. He mentioned that he had caught some fish that day and brought them home to his family to eat for dinner. Her family and friends were in shock. They couldn't believe that she was killed just for being at the wrong place at the wrong time. People who know Israel Keyes were not able to believe that he could do something like this. But he kept talking. He said that there was no one who knows him, not the real him. He said he was basically 2 different people. The one that everyone knows and the one that he is. He said he's been like this for at least 14 years. Police believe this meant that he was killing people for that entire time. Keyes admitted to several different murders, but would not give details. He would talk in gory detail about what he did to each victim, but he wouldn't always give away the name, or when, or where, or even that clearly how. He loved to have control over the police and the distribution of information. Police had to track everywhere he had been over that 14 years just to give them an idea of where some of the victims might be. After a lot of give and take, he admitted to 2 more killings, but of course those had terms too. Of course, before giving that information, he set his terms, and they were that he didn't want any information being shared by media because he didn't want his daughter to see it. He also wanted an immediate execution date. He believed that he could have a date without any trial or any proof that he actually did the murders. At this point, police didn't know if he was even telling the truth about these victims and thought that perhaps he was making up stories for attention. Of course, police couldn't give him an execution date, but they promised to keep his name out of the media. He wasn't happy with this. So the police used a tactic that might help their case. They said that if he would be willing to provide details on all the murders that he committed, it'd be much more likely that he would have an execution, and that if he pled guilty, that date would be set and it would come more quickly. Key still wasn't on board at first, but after a few more hours of talking, he gave the names Bill and Lorraine Currier, who were 48 and 45 years old respectively. They were from Essex, Vermont, on the other side of the country. This man was a serious traveler. He would often fly to a location and then rent a car and drive hundreds of miles to kill someone or to hide kill kits, which I'll talk about later. He always paid with cash and turned off his phone, so he was totally undetectable as he moved from place to place. He claimed that in June of 2011, he flew from Anchorage to Chicago and then rented a car and drove to Vermont. The only intention of the trip was to kill someone. This is when police learned about his kill kits. They also learned that he had no type. It could be a man, a woman, old, young, black, brown, red, white, female, male, guess I already said that, or any combination of all of those. It could be a couple, they could be alone, they could be a husband, wife, mother, daughter, or anyone. The only thing that mattered to him was location and preparation for a quick kill. Also a little bit on timing, right? Because it had to happen in a period of time that he had set aside just to do this. He would travel all over the country and even into other countries. He had been to Texas, Vermont, Indiana, Alaska, Oregon, Washington, Wyoming, New York, New Jersey. He had been through Egypt and all through South America. Part of this was through the army, and some were through his own, quote, vacations. During all this travel, he would hide his kill kits. These would be 5-gallon buckets that were waterproofed with lids. He would fill them with guns, ammo, Drano, knives, ropes, duct tape, maybe a tarp, pretty much everything that you would need to abduct, murder, and dispose of someone. No one really knows what he did after using the kits, or what he did with the kits. I think that he probably put them somewhere else so that he could come back and use them again, but no one knows for sure. He admitted to having 11 or 12 of these. He used one of these for the killing of Bill and Lorraine. He had hidden the kit in 2009 and then returned in 2011 to use it. This is very unique. Most serial killers are waiting for a specific person or are triggered by a person, but not Keyes. He didn't care who it was. He didn't stalk a particular person or a particular type. He got off on the torture and the killing. He wasn't motivated necessarily by sexual desires or hatred for a certain type of person. He just liked to kill people, and when he got the urge, he would do it. He drove to Essex and stayed in a hotel. Then he just drove around until he found the victims. In this case, it was two people. He found an old house and decided that he would bring his victim to the house. So he drove back to town and just picked a neighborhood. Any neighborhood would do. So he did that. Then he walked around on foot and looked for a house that had no sign of pets or kids. He said they complicated matters. And he also stated that after his daughter was born, he would no longer kill children. This is fascinating because he didn't seem to have any rules about the type of person he picked as his target. And I think it's interesting that he said this. It makes me wonder if he had killed children at some point. He looked at the yards and found one with no kids' toys and no sign of any pet. He waited until dark and then broke into the garage via a fan that was placed in the wall. He then broke the glass door that went from the garage to the house and immediately tied both the victims up. He then told them that they were going to drive in their car to the location of his choice. He also had them put slippers on to keep their feet from getting hurt as they walked over the glass he had broken. I believe this was a strategy to keep them calm, but who knows why he really did it. He had them drive to the abandoned house, where he put Bill in the basement and kept Lorraine upstairs. She began to get loose from her ties when Keyes was tying Bill up, but Keyes was able to get the situation back under control, and he began to sexually assault her. While he was assaulting her, Bill was almost able to break free from his ties in the basement. At this point, Keyes was fed up, so he shot Bill. He then went back upstairs and strangled Lorraine. He put their bodies in trash bags and put them under some debris in the basement of the abandoned home. He then drove hundreds of miles back to Chicago and then eventually went home to Alaska. Bill and Lorraine had been reported missing, and the police were baffled as to what happened to them. they found absolutely no evidence of anything in the car when it was eventually found. They saw the break-in, but no evidence of struggle, and nothing was missing from the home. They looked like they had left willingly. A passerby helped the police to make a sketch of someone that they believed was driving Bill and Lorraine's car. This sketch is available to see online, as well as the video of Samantha being kidnapped, and if you really want to look hard enough, you can find the picture of her where she's holding, where he's holding the newspaper next to her head. The sketch that was drawn does look a lot like Keyes, but other than that, there was nothing else to tie him to those murders. When family and friends heard about Keyes' involvement, they were horrified and shocked at the randomness of this killing. They were confused because there was no link between the two of them, and they wondered how some stranger could kill just this nice, friendly couple. The police in Vermont immediately went to where the house was, where the murders took place, but were disappointed because it had been torn down. It was demolished shortly after the couple had been killed. The demolition crew said it smelled really bad in the house, but they didn't see anything inside. Crews searched the house where the hole, essentially, where the bodies were thought to be. I mean, there was rubble and earth covering it, and they looked for 12 weeks but didn't find the bodies or any clues that would link Keyes to the murder. When police told Keyes this, he laughed and said he had no idea. Police were starting to get irritated with him because he was basically running them in circles. Some people believed he did know that the house was demolished, and others believed the whole story about bringing them there was a lie. The story may have just been his way of showing off his work without actually providing any evidence to them. They tried to get him to give them the location of the kill kit, but he wouldn't. He did give them the location of one in Alaska, and one was later found in Wyoming. It was found near the Green River and had all the materials that Keyes said would be in it. The kit there had no DNA evidence at all. The kill kit that was in Vermont was found later. It was about a half mile down a path near a river in a secluded, wooded area. In this kit, they found one bullet with a perfect thumbprint that matched Keyes. When Keyes was told this information, it was the first time he showed any true emotion. He was really upset that he hadn't done a good job. I think he just felt disappointed that, you know, he didn't do it perfectly and was getting caught for something finally. At this point, police released his name to the media. This angered Keyes greatly. He told them he'll no longer tell them anything about what he had done. He stopped asking them for things. No more cigarettes or cigars and Snickers for him. He lost control, but as the police pushed and pushed, he did divulge a little bit more information. He said shortly before he joined the army, he was working in Oregon on the Deschutes River. It was known to be a great place to float. People would sit in tubes and just meander down the river. He said that he saw a group of people and noticed that a young girl was floating a little bit further behind the rest of the group. He watched her, and when she was far enough away, he entered the water and took her. He took her to the bathroom nearby, and he said she couldn't have been older than 18, probably somewhere between 12 and 18. He tied her up and sexually assaulted her. He had full intention to kill her, but she wouldn't stop talking, and she was starting to get to him. He couldn't seem to dehumanize her like he could many other people. She promised that if he let her go, she wouldn't tell anyone, and eventually he did let her go. That was the last time he let anyone go, because he felt he had been weak. To this date, this young woman had never come forward. I hope she does, at some point. I am sure she was traumatized, but perhaps with time and healing and becoming stronger, she might one day come forward. He then went to the army, entered the army. And he then went to the army, but after being in the army for a little while, that's kind of when he decided to act out on his fantasies. When he finally was back in Nea Bay, Alaska, he said that he found himself bored and killed his first victim right there in Nea Bay. A couple months later, he claims to have killed two more victims in Washington. He said it was a male and a female. He said he didn't know how he killed the woman that he killed, but he killed the man with a shovel. I don't know why he said he didn't know how he killed the woman. How could you not know? Maybe he just wouldn't admit to how he did it. I bet that's what really happened there. He said that in 2005 or 6, he killed two more people. He talked a lot about Crescent Lake, which he knew to be very deep, and it's believed he put a body there, but it's not feasible to search that lake. They also believe they have narrowed down the victims, or a victim, but they're not completely sure at this time. They believe that this victim was a child, but Key's child had already been born by this time. And of course, he was probably lying when he said he wouldn't kill children after his daughter was born. They also believe that he may have killed someone in New York in around 2009, about the time he buried the kill kit in Vermont. He had made a road trip up the East Coast, and during that time, a woman named Deborah Feldwin went missing from New Jersey. The date of disappearance was hard to pin down because she was a bit of a drifter. Police believe she was taken on April 9th, when Israel was around. They knew he was in the area because he robbed a bank. Yep, he was also a bank robber. This bank was in Tupper Lake, New York. He admitted to this. They believe she was picked up in New Jersey and then disposed of in New York. Her name was found on Israel's computer, and that's how she's linked to him. He had nothing much on his computer except for a long list of names. When police came to him with this information, he was pissed. He hadn't given it to them, and that's what made him angry. He also said he didn't know her. He said he didn't have any names on his computer, and he realized at that time he was losing control even more. About the same time that he was in New York and New Jersey, he robbed the bank and stashed a kill kit. Sometimes when he was on these trips, he would even commit arson. It was almost like he just held everything in and just all of a sudden he just would combust and just wreak havoc. When he robbed the bank, he wrote a note for the teller and said that he hoped to not have to use a gun. However, there were too many people in the bank, so he did end up pulling out the gun. There is a picture of him from the robbery, and he is dressed similarly to how he was when he drew the money from the ATMs. People's minds are blown that he got away with all of this. He would just go mad, and then he would vanish. He was also very opportunistic. In fact, when he was making the withdrawals from the ATMs in Arizona and Texas, he was driving to attend his sister's wedding. They believe that while on planned trips is when he would plan his kills. Sometimes these trips might be, I don't know, maybe for work or visiting family, who knows. It gave him time alone to do what he really wanted to do without questions from his family. It's believed that he was planning to kill someone while on that trip. He much preferred to ambush people, but the urge to kill was growing, and he considered killing a couple sitting on a bench in Alaska, but a police car drove by. He was frustrated, and this is exactly what led to the killing of Samantha. In November of 2012, 11 skulls, pictures of skulls, were found in his cell. They had been drawn in his blood, and this led police to believe that there were 11 victims. They began to state that there were 11 victims because Keyes would often correct them if they had the details wrong, but he never corrected them on this number. Some people believe he started killing earlier, that he did harm children, and that there are more victims. Locals believe that a girl who lived in Colville, who disappeared at the same time Keyes was living there, may be one of his victims. It would have been around the time he was realizing that he wanted to kill. She had two prosthetic feet, so she would have been an easy target. Her prosthetic feet were found in a river, and a year later, the remains of the rest of her body were found. Friends of this girl said that she actually met Keyes at a local pool, and that she gave him her address and phone number. The girls had never come forward this information before, and it's unknown whether this is proven to be true. Authorities also asked him if he'd ever killed anyone in Canada, as he traveled in that area. He traveled the Alaskan Highway in Canada for about a week, traveling towards Alaska. His response, and this is chilling, was, "Canadians don't count." Some people believe that he may have contributed to some of the deaths along the Trail of Tears. This is a highway where people have been found killed since the early 70s. Clearly, he didn't contribute to the early murders, but murders have continued there, so he may have been one of the ones killing along that area. Perhaps the story of the Trail of Tears will be told in a future episode on this podcast. Finally, in November of 2012, they tried to give him back control. They decided that he might enjoy using a drone to help find the kill kits. He did enjoy it, but 2 days later, Keyes was found dead in his cell. He had cut his wrists with a blade from a razor and also hung himself. A suicide note was found, but it was ridiculous. It was more like an ode to killing and a terrible poem all at once, and was of no use to the police. He talked about how much he hated America and seemed like the poem was maybe about a person he killed or maybe that he fantasized about killing. It was in the form of a poem, like I said, which made it so much weirder. I personally believe this man killed more than 11 people, and considering he killed two people at a time, it seemed like, pretty regularly, it makes me think that he didn't start like that, and that he probably started with someone easy and built his confidence with the more that he did. He also claims to have killed the first Nia Bay victim and the two victims in Washington within months of each other. So three in just a few months, and then only eight over the next 10 years? It seems doubtful to me that he held himself back after starting so ferociously. The FBI has released a timeline and are asking for help. You can go to their site and look at it. If you have a missing person who vanished in those areas during the time that he traveled there, you should let the FBI know. There are also long interviews that are able to be watched. They are frustrating to watch because he's so meandering and circling around, and it's kind of irritating to listen to. Like we said earlier, police believe there was a victim in the Green River, Wyoming area, since he seemed to kill near where his kill kits were. In 2007, he spent a lot of time in the California wine country, so there may be victims there as well. He stayed in Hillsburg while there, and he rented a kayak at a campground. He had previously told police that he would hide bodies by boat or kayak, so this may be what he was doing while he was there. There are still kill kits to be found, as well as money stashes from bank robberies. It's likely that hunters or hikers may find these in time. Hopefully they'll let the police know if and when they do, because that way they can possibly link missing persons to the kill kits. It's scary because it's likely that many people won't turn these in, as they have no idea it might be linked to Keyes. So please share this information with your friends who like to hunt, hike, road trip, or travel a lot. All of you living in your outfitted vans and mobile homes and tent campers, please keep your eyes open for these kits. There are pictures on the FBI's website that show what one of his kill kits looks like. On a more personal note, as Indiana is my home state and Fort Wayne is near my hometown, I have to let you Hoosiers know that he was here from December 8th to 11th in 2007. He rented a car in Fort Wayne and put 537 miles on it and returned it one day late. He may have killed someone or perhaps hidden a kill kit. If you know of a missing person during this time, or have found a sealed bucket of guns or a cache of money, please let the FBI know. So this sends the story of Israel Keyes, who kept a lot of secrets and may be a very prolific serial killer. Thank you so much for listening. Please share this podcast with your friends. Word of mouth is all I have at this time, but I'm confident this podcast will grow with your help. As always, I'm open to suggestions and constructive criticism. If you have a case you think would be good to cover, please feel free to share that as well. Our email is twistedtravelandtruecrime@gmail.com. Thanks again, and I wish you all fair winds and following seas.